Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Autism, A Very Short Introduction by Uta Frith, narrated by Leslie Belair.
Chapter 1. The Autism Spectrum. Is it autism? Imagine a young mother and her baby. She adores him, and he is gorgeous. But deep down, Diane can't help worrying, just occasionally, whether Mickey will grow up a normal, happy boy. How could she tell if he has autism, for example? There is so much about autism in the news. Almost 1 in 100 children born are autistic, with 5 times as many boys as girls. An autistic child conjures up all sorts of scenarios, most of them bleak. And what are the first signs of autism? Is it significant that Mickey cries a lot, doesn't sleep much, and is not easily calmed? Lots of babies are like that, Diane's mother says. She worries, however, that Mickey does not always turn around when she calls him from across the room. When Diane started to read about autism, she found the information quite unsettling. She read that some children are very delayed in their general development. Then there were some children who gave no cause for concern at all until well into their second year of life. One child never spoke. Another was actually a little genius. Diane, like many people who are starting to find out about autism, is perplexed, but also intrigued. The Enigma of Autism. When I first started to study autism as a young student in London in the 1960s, I too was perplexed and intrigued. More than that, I was utterly fascinated as well as puzzled by the children I saw at London's Maudsley Hospital, where I trained to be a clinical psychologist. Because of this fascination, I never worked as a clinical psychologist, but became a research scientist instead. But of course, fascination is not enough. At that time, the Maudsley Hospital housed 4 of the pioneers of autism research: child psychiatrist Michael Rutter, epidemiologist Lorna Wing, and psychologists Neil O'Connor and Beata Hermelin. I had read some of their papers, but did not even realize that they worked at the same place. The papers reported ingenious experiments on perception and memory. They compared children who were then labeled mentally retarded and children then just beginning to be labeled autistic, and they found clear differences between the groups. These differences were clues to different minds. They could not be trivially explained by lack of intelligence or lack of motivation. I was completely bowled over by the fact that such elegant experiments could be done and gave such clear results. Beata Hermelin and Neil O'Connor had already worked out ways of answering questions that puzzled me deeply. For example, why do some tasks, apparently simple, seem quite impossible for autistic children? Why are they doing well on other tasks which appear difficult for others? Why is a child who has a good memory for words unable to comprehend their meaning? I now believe that it was just these paradoxes and puzzles that cast something of a spell on me. They kept urging me to find solutions. 40 years later, the spell is still powerful. Although there are answers to some of these questions, and we will explore them in this book, there is much more still to be discovered, and the puzzle of autism is far from being solved. What I learned right at the beginning is that with autism, nothing is what it seems at first glance. Just because a child with autism doesn't respond to your overtures doesn't mean that the child rejects you. The reasons for not responding are much deeper. Further, just because a child can remember words and pictures does not mean that they can remember names and faces of people. One of the most startling realizations that hit me was that being autistic could be in many ways worse than being born blind or deaf. Autistic children, barring exceptions, can see and hear, often exquisitely well. But while blind and deaf children can still receive and respond to social signals through a special sense, autistic children don't have this sense. It is hard to imagine what it is like not to have a social sense, not to be tuned in to other people, their actions, reactions, and the signals they give out to you and each other. As it is, autistic children are not tuned into these things. However, they do have mental capacities that help them to learn about these signals, but they learn in a different way. Sadly, the knowledge they acquire is not the same as the ordinary tuned-in knowledge that we all take for granted. A colorblind person can acquire knowledge of colors and name them correctly, but their experience of colors will remain different. So it is with autism and the experience of social communication. Why does learning in autism proceed along a different route? Because autism starts so early in life, many of the social routes to learning about the world are blocked. Normally developing children can easily follow the path that has been carved out by evolution and culture. But autistic children have to find their own special routes on the byways. This makes them very different from each other, as well as different from children who do not have autism. The autism spectrum. When I first saw autistic children, I was only dimly aware that autism comes in degrees, from mild to severe. Actually, all the cases I saw were severe. When I see autistic children now, I am still surprised at how many cases are high-functioning and how many cases have only mild and moderate degrees of autism. To see a child with classic autism has become the exception. But I am reassured that such cases are still there and that they have the same features as they did 40 years ago. However, autism is no longer a narrow category, but has widened enormously to embrace a whole range of autistic conditions. It has now become generally accepted to talk about an autism spectrum. What is meant by this spectrum? Actually, it hides a vast array of autisms. All the autisms originate from before birth, and all affect the developing brain. However, their effect on the developing mind can be very different. Consequently, there is a vastly different range of behaviors. Sometimes a family can be justly proud of their child, who is interestingly different, and possibly gifted in some special way. Sometimes a family will be destroyed because their child will be so difficult to manage that they simply cannot cope. Of course, there are many shades in between, and most cases come with a mixture of rewarding and fascinating, as well as aggravating and challenging features. Every individual is unique in a multitude of ways, but they also resemble each other in some fundamental preferences and characteristics. What binds them all together, the mild and severe forms of the spectrum? At the core, there is always a characteristic inability to engage in ordinary reciprocal social interaction. There is also a characteristic rigidity of behavior with a multitude of consequences. That is why no one has yet given up the idea that there is a common pattern behind the kaleidoscope of individual behaviors. I will therefore frequently use the familiar terms autism and autistic as a reminder that there is a central idea behind the spectrum. Three cases. Now we shall look at three cases closely based on real cases from different parts of the autism spectrum. David has classic autism. Gary has an autism spectrum disorder, ASD, with a diffuse and atypical picture, but such complex cases are actually quite common. Edward has classic Asperger syndrome. David. David was three when he was diagnosed as autistic. At that time, he hardly looked at people, was not talking, and seemed lost in his own world. He loved to bounce on a trampoline for hours and was extremely adept at doing jigsaw puzzles. At 10 years of age, David had developed well physically, but emotionally remained very immature. He had a beautiful face with delicate features. Family life has always had to fit around David, not the other way round. He was and still is extremely stubborn in his likes and dislikes. At one stage, he only ate yogurt and refused all other kinds of food. More often than not, his mother has to give in to his urgent and repeated demands, which easily escalate into tantrums. David learned to talk when he was 5. He now goes to a special school for autistic children, where he is happy. He has a daily routine, which he never varies. It is hard to tell how intelligent David is. Some things he learns with great skill and speed. For example, he learned to read all by himself. He now reads fluently, but he doesn't understand what he reads. He also loves to do sums. However, he has been extremely slow to learn other skills, for example, eating at the family table or getting dressed. David has an excellent memory. He imitates what he hears very precisely and has a beautiful singing voice. He also has perfect pitch. David is now 12 years old. He still does not spontaneously play with other children. He has obvious difficulties in communicating with other people who don't know him well. With those who do know him, he communicates entirely on his own terms. He makes no concessions to their wishes or interests and cannot take on board another person's point of view. In this way, David is indifferent to the social world and continues to live in a world of his own. Gary. When Gary was at primary school, an experienced teacher observed that he had unusual problems in communicating with other children and could not manage to work in a group in class. Gary's parents accepted these problems as part of his personality. He seemed to be a very obstinate child and happy to play computer games for hours. Referred to an educational psychologist by the school, when problems with Gary seemed only to get worse, he was eventually seen at a clinic at age 12. The psychologist explained that Gary had a pervasive developmental disorder, a category that includes autism, Asperger syndrome, and a few other rare conditions. Actually, Gary was diagnosed as having PDDNOS, pervasive developmental disorder not otherwise specified. This is a category for cases that have autistic features, but not all features are necessarily present. The psychologist also mentioned Asperger syndrome when she talked to Gary's parents. They immediately favored this label as it helped them to explain Gary's problems to other people. The psychological assessments showed that Gary also had attention deficit disorder and dyspraxia, as evident in his clumsiness on motor tasks. His main problems, however, were poor communication skills and an inability to understand other people. Gary was placed in a succession of different schools. In each case, he was said to be difficult and disruptive. He bitterly complained about being bullied. Sadly, he was. However, Gary's classmates made some efforts to understand him, but they failed because Gary could not tell the difference between being teased or criticized. Gary is now in his 20s and lives at home. So far, he has shown little interest in his mother's suggestions for finding a job and still spends most of his time playing computer games. Gary often says that he would like to have a girlfriend. On one occasion, he had started to follow an attractive young woman everywhere, waiting outside her house for hours, but never talking to her. Now Gary's family are watching carefully for signs of inappropriate social behavior. At his mother's insistence, Gary has joined a social skills group for people with Asperger syndrome, and he now attends the monthly meetings without fail. Edward. Edward was diagnosed as having Asperger syndrome at the age of 8. Although clearly very bright, his teacher felt at her wit's end with him. She said that she could not teach him, and that instead he taught himself, but only what he wanted to learn. He could not make any attempts to fit in with ordinary classroom activities, and he refused point-blank to follow the set curriculum. Edward's family had not realized the extent of this problem. On the contrary, they had always thought of Edward as an extraordinarily gifted child. By 5 years of age, he had acquired an astounding vocabulary, mainly by reading dictionaries. He was rather fearful of playing with other children, but relished the attention he got from adults. His family dotes on him, and he seems to share a lot of interests and mannerisms with his father. Both are bookish people and can talk very persistently about their interests. Edward started to collect birds' eggs from about the age of 4 and has developed an intricate system for classifying them. Edward is now 20 years old and is about to study maths at a top university. He went to a private school where the teachers were sympathetic and let him follow his own interests. At school, he obtained excellent marks in all science subjects. Other subjects simply did not interest him. He proclaimed loudly that literature was a waste of time. Apart from being in the chess club, he never became part of a circle of friends. Outwardly, Edward dismisses all social events as a bore. He is fluent when he talks with his father and corresponds with ornithologists all over the world, but seems to be tongue-tied when faced with people his own age. Edward sticks out in a crowd, not only by his tall and lanky appearance, but also by his mannerisms and loud, high-pitched voice. However, he has started to read books of manners and body language and is hoping they will improve his social skills. Edward is very knowledgeable about Asperger syndrome and avidly participates in Asperger discussion forums on the web. He knows that he is far more intelligent than most neurotypicals. However, there are signs that Edward is often anxious and sometimes depressed, and he is being seen by a psychiatrist who will carefully monitor him in the transition period when he leaves home to go to college. The three core features of the autism spectrum. The examples of David, Gary, and Edward show how enormously varied the core signs of autism are, at least on the surface. Therefore, a lot of clinical experience is needed to make a diagnosis. The behavior of each individual differs according to so many factors that they are difficult to list, but they include at least age, family background, general ability, education, and the child's own temperament and personality. Nevertheless, there is common ground. These are the core features of the autism spectrum, the chief diagnostic criteria. You can find them on several helpful websites. Here we unpack their meaning using our example cases. The first of the core features of ASD concerns reciprocal social interaction. It is not enough to be a loner, to behave embarrassingly, or to be clumsy in social situations. The difficulty reveals itself most acutely in peer interactions. At young ages, this means other children, not adults. Adults often make huge allowances to smooth over awkward social situations. A clear sign of failing reciprocal interaction is a lack of engagement with other children. In the case of David, the failure in social interaction can at first glance be described as a lack of social interest or aloofness as regards other people. However, this aloofness is actually an inability to engage with others, even to the extent that he never asked to be taught to read, but taught himself. Gary is unable to read the social signals of others. He has no idea how to get a girlfriend, although he would very much like to have one. Edward can socially interact with people who appreciate his intelligence, but avoids social interaction with his peers. He tries to find out about social rules. The second related core feature concerns communication. Deep down, the ability to communicate hinges on a message being acknowledged as happening. One person needs to wish to communicate, and the other needs to wish to receive the communication. Communication does not have to be spoken words, but can be gestures or facial expressions. Without the signs that accompany sending and receiving a message, there can be no true communication. David has the most severe problems in communication. He spoke late, and his use of language is extremely limited, that is, he uses it if he wants something, but not to express feelings or thoughts. Gary has more subtle difficulties. He finds it impossible to know whether people make jokes from the way they talk, and feels rebuffed when he tries to talk to others. Edward is highly articulate, but he does not enjoy ordinary chit-chat. His ability to engage in a two-way conversation has improved since he has started systematically to gather information about communication through reading books on etiquette and body language and through reading about Asperger syndrome. The third core feature is of a different kind from the first two. It is about repetitive activities and narrow interests. What is autistic about these features, which seem not unfamiliar to many parents of young children? Lining blocks or cars up in neat little patterns may be cute just once or twice, but it becomes very sad when this is done day after day without exploring other possibilities of playing with blocks or cars. It is the extreme nature of the repetitions and the obsessive quality of the interests that are typical of autism. Another way to look at repetitive behavior is to think of it as extreme stubbornness. In fact, there is a strong resistance to change and an aversion to novelty. Doing the same thing, exactly the same thing, watching the same video, eating the same food day after day, is the kind of excessive pattern that is found in autistic children. It is often less noticeable in autistic adults, where the behavioral repertoire has widened through learning and experience. David's love of bouncing is an example of repetitive action, and his interest in print and reading was described as obsessive. Gary did not have this feature, and this made his diagnosis less straightforward. His interest in computer games was not really different from that of other young people. Edward had a number of different intensely pursued interests in succession. At one point, he abandoned his interest in dictionaries and took up maths instead. The pictures on the preceding pages show examples of what it is that clinicians focus on as significant signs or symptoms of autism in the childhood years. In the next chapter, we will look at how some of the behavioral signs change with age. Everyone agrees that autism is a developmental disorder. Development means change, and in autism it usually means improvement, an increasing ability to cope with the frightening aspects of a world that is not shared and therefore unpredictable. the repetitive and obsessive features often also fade to have a less severe impact on life. These improvements can all be expected when there is good education and support for the growing child and his or her family. When does autism start? This is a long and complicated story, as yet unreadable to us. Autism has its origin well before birth. At some point, a tiny fault occurs. This fault is somewhere in the genetic program that results in a human being with its enormously complex central nervous system. This fault is so subtle that for the most part, the program runs off smoothly and a baby is born who looks perfectly healthy. Only from about the second year of life do the consequences of the tiny fault emerge with rather major and sometimes devastating effects. Why only then? Perhaps this point in time is critical for the foundation of typically human social behavior, more critical even than the social interest that is already there in the first year. This is worth dwelling on. The healthy newborn infant, straight from birth, shows strong signs of social interest. For instance, babies prefer to look at a face rather than at a pattern, and a real face rather than a scrambled face. They prefer direct eye contact to averted eyes. They prefer to listen to speech rather than scrambled sounds. They turn to people, smile at people, show responses to familiar adults that are different from strangers, and so on. Babies are such powerfully social creatures for a reason. For thousands of years of evolution, babies have utterly depended on other human beings for their survival. And yet, the social gifts they manifest so early are quite one-sided. They cry, they look, they smile, and they babble. All these behaviors act as powerful social signals for the mother. Crying, for example, will ensure that the baby gets food and comfort. However, it seems that there is a step change in human social development at the end of the first year of life. It goes together with a step change in general physical and mental development. The baby starts to walk and to talk. Something happens that lifts the already flourishing but perhaps mainly one-sided interaction onto a different level where interactions are truly reciprocal. And here lies the core social problem in autism. Everyone can see that in the first year of life, a baby grows in size and weight at amazing speed, but we can't see how its brain grows. Almost all the nerve cells of the brain are already there at birth. It is the connections between the nerve cells that grow so phenomenally. The system is being wired up with millions and millions of connectors, synapses, and connecting fibers. The brain's communication highways are being constructed. This construction also includes eliminating bad or unnecessary connections. As the baby turns into a toddler, there is a major reorganization of the brain, and with it is a major change in the way the child interacts with other human beings. Given that autism has social impairments at its core, one might expect that these impairments should be obvious even in the first year of life. It is remarkable that they are not. It is generally in the second year that autistic development starts to deviate from the norm, not in the first. Autistic babies seemingly stay behind and do not make the vital step change in social interaction towards true joint interaction. What is joint attention? There is attention from one individual to another, and there is joint attention, where two individuals are deliberately and simultaneously attending to an object. This accomplishment is thought by many to be the basis of true reciprocal interaction, and however social the baby is from birth, joint attention is not shown until the end of the first year of life or even later. Lack of joint attention in a toddler is a worrying sign of autism. At the same time, it is a behavior that is difficult to induce in children who do not show it spontaneously. What constitutes joint attention? One individual can draw the attention of another to share interest in an object, and this shared interest is in itself enjoyable. Eye gaze can direct attention, and so can pointing with a finger and showing an object. One of the earliest signs of autism is that the child shows little sign of trying to attract the attention of another person by look or gesture. Instead, the child appears to be oblivious to the other person present. In fact, autistic children are not oblivious. They are, of course, utterly dependent on other people and rely on them to have their desires and needs fulfilled. Indeed, the child can show this dependence in a most pathetic way. for instance, by crying disconsolately or by dragging a person by the hand to a place where they hope to get what they need. These apparently desperate attempts seem strange to parents when they would be only too ready to help the child if only the child gave them a small hint. But this is exactly what the autistic child can't do. He or she cannot elicit the attention in what seems to everyone a perfectly simple and obvious way, for instance by seeking eye contact and trying to engage the adult by simple gestures. And yet it is difficult to recognize the absence of these signs. Sometimes children who have perfectly healthy brains are slow at developing social skills. Children's temperament and social interests differ, and some are slow at learning to speak. This was the case with Mickey. As a baby, he did not show a lot of social interest, and sometimes he seemed oblivious when called by name. This was worrying. However, on his second birthday, he gave clear signs of joint attention. When his grandmother visited, he held up his new teddy to her and laughed when she pretended to talk to the teddy. Regression or lack of progress. Alice reported that her son Tom had spoken very early. His first words, at the age of 10 months, were car, plane, bike. He was a healthy and happy baby, walking at 10 months and exploring his environment with great energy like any other toddler. He acquired at least another dozen words, but from about 18 months, Tom seemed to become more absorbed with himself, and it gradually dawned on Alice that he never spoke anymore. He seemed to have lost interest in his surroundings and did not progress like other toddlers. A year later, Tom was diagnosed autistic with regressive development. Alice learned that this pattern of sad decline was quite frequent, and there was nothing and nobody that could be blamed for the autism. At least 30% of parents have this experience. The question is whether there is actually a decline and a regression, or is it more a lack of progress towards another stage of development? Could it be that Tom was like other children at first, but then other children zoomed ahead because they had entered a new phase of mental development? Alice thought she noticed a distinct change, and she agonized about what might have triggered this change in Tom. She could simply not accept that a perfectly normal baby who showed plentiful signs of social interest should suddenly start behaving like an autistic child. Something must have happened. Perhaps an unnoticed brain disease, perhaps some kind of poisoning from a substance that may be harmless to others. This is almost certainly not the case for Tom. Actually, it is extremely rare that autism is caused by some external agent. However, only solid research about the actual course of development of the brain in autism will remove these inevitable worries. The case of Patricia was quite different. She was always concerned that there was something wrong. Her daughter Sylvia was a restless and difficult baby who cried a lot and slept very little. She played intensely with her rattle and gazed at the pattern of the curtains with her big, beautiful eyes. During the second year, it became abundantly clear to Patricia that other children of Sylvia's age were a long way ahead in their development. While Sylvia was physically progressing very well, mentally she seemed to stay very much as she had been as a baby. Her interests in particular toys became even more intense, and it was difficult to attract her attention away from them. She never seemed to look at people. She only turned to others when she needed something that instant. She never looked at her dolls and teddies either. She turned away when other children came and invited her to play. Other children pointed to objects and pictures in books and rapidly learned their names. Sylvia did none of these things. Patricia reported later that she had hoped that Sylvia's difficulties as a baby were somehow to do with colic or teething and would go away once she was older. The frequent crying did go away, but Sylvia continued to be a poor sleeper. Patricia was rightly alarmed when Sylvia did not show interest in other children and did not pick up language. Alice and Patricia had very different experiences with their children. But it turned out later that the development of both Tom and Sylvia was not actually very dissimilar. Both were given help from a speech therapist, and both eventually learned to talk. Their mental development improved by leaps and bounds when they attended a specialist school. What about little Mickey? Not all children are equally sociable, and they don't develop equally fast. Mickey did learn to speak quite late, but he turned out to be a very friendly but occasionally shy little boy with a lot of imagination and a dry sense of humor. Diane was able to put her worries about autism aside when Mickey entered nursery school. She could see that he fitted in with the other children, playing in the playhouse and taking his beloved Teddy for a picnic together with his friends' teddies. When she came to fetch him...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?